Well, we're going to continue our discussion with Matthew LaCroix, The Stage of Time, and then we'll take your calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Matthew LaCroix with us. Matthew, what do you think of the late Zechariah Sitchin's theories of the Anunnaki coming here from another planet to manipulate and genetically alter what was humans at the time to create, you know, workers and do their thing?
I do feel that there is a lot of good information that can come from Zechariah Sitchin. But I think, like all researchers, we should always be objective with that information and not simply just accept one researcher's perspective rather than expanding out and looking at it in a lot of other areas as well. I think a lot of Zechariah Sitchin got a lot of things right. But I think he also did get a few things that were missed translations. And a couple of those things are that I don't think that potentially those beings have been portrayed like some have thought. I don't think that they came here for gold or anything like he talks about. I think that they came here for energy. I think that they came here to try to find eternal life and to try to go beyond this physical existence that we have to exist in. And the reason I think that is that when you actually go in and you read things like the Atrahasis, like we talked about before, there's this one phrase they talk about how Enki was supposed to create the human race because he was supposed to undo the chain to set them free. And that was why he was assigned the certain role that he was within our reality. That's the way that I interpret a lot of this stuff by actually reading these cuneiform tablets directly. Not reading another researcher, but actually going and looking. And I think that's what everyone needs to do. And that's why I included so many of these ancient translations in The Stage of Time, because when people actually read these, when they read the Enuma Elish, they read the Atrahasis, they read the Legend of Itania, they actually get to get a glimpse of this information directly. And I try to include always, of course, you got to always find the most accurate translations. And I mentioned before how George Smith translated a lot of this in the 1800s. Well, later, his counterpart, named Stephanie Daly, she's an expert Assyriologist. It came out of Oxford University, and she does a fantastic job taking George Smith's translations and then verifying them and updating them slightly. And when you get those two experts that look over these tablets, you really get and translate them correctly. You really get an understanding of, well, who were these Anunnaki that they call themselves the Anunna? You know, who were they? Why did they come here? Why did they influence the human race and then have things end up the way that they are now?
And why did they leave?
What?
And why did they leave?
Yeah, it seems that after those cataclysms occurred, there was a total disconnect between what those ancient civilizations called the gods and how that all of a sudden became disconnected here. And then human civilizations, after they later developed, were tried to restart themselves and brought a lot of this wisdom back, but it just wasn't enough, and that's how we ended up in the place we are today, where we've largely lost most of the information that we were able to that we had once long ago.
And also, you have spent a lot of time in your last chapter talking about a planetary system and a binary star system in the solar system. Tell me about that.
Sure. So that's some pretty amazing work. I'd like to try to think that I'm one of the ones that's on the front lines of that, because I was made aware by another researcher a long time ago that there exists an encyclopedia that actually portrays aspects of our outer solar system that have been very much hidden and suppressed from people knowing about them. When I started to do some digging, it wasn't just about learning about ancient history and about our past. It was about learning the secrets of our solar system and the universe as well. I wanted to understand what the nature of reality is and what defines this neighborhood we live in, this little solar system, this corner of the Milky Way, on one of the spiral bands. And what I found, the more I started to dig, the more I started to look into some of the data in our outer solar system and some of the anomalies that have been seen, you find that there exist aspects of our outer solar system that have been completely hidden from society. And what you find is that we may actually have a binary star that is part of our outer solar system, as well as another planet. Now, this has been confused with the term Nibiru, but I don't believe they're actually one and the same. I think Nibiru might have been a mistranslation. The name that's been given for this planet was originally Planet X. Later, it was changed to Planet 9 based on the demotion of Pluto.
Mm-hmm.
So you may ask yourself, like, where is any of this evidence, right? Like, where is any of this that makes any sense? Well, it's very important to understand that in 1983, NASA sent out a probe called Pioneer 10. And the goal of Pioneer 10, this probe, was to explore the outer solar system. And the only reason they did that was because they were finding these protrusions to the orbits of our outer planets, Uranus and Neptune. They found that they're tilted on their axis, and something is disrupting them far out, and they wanted to find out what it was. And so they sent Pioneer 10 out in 1983, and they also sent another probe called Pioneer 11. They both went different directions. Pioneer 11 didn't find anything, but Pioneer 10 found some of the most significant discoveries literally in human history, and people don't even know about them. That's what's so amazing about it. And the reason you know that is go look up Pioneer 10 and go look into this incredible piece of information that is just starting to be known by people. It's called the 1987 New Illustrated Science and Invention Encyclopedia, Volume 18. So this, what this is there's a volume of encyclopedias that comes out every year. And it was back before the internet, these encyclopedias were the rule when it came to information. That's how you looked things up.
Oh, yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Well, in 1987, they released this encyclopedia that covered all aspects of everything. But one part that it covered was about the solar system. And on page 2,488, they included information about what Pioneer 10 found. Now, if you go look in other places, you won't find anything. It's like all the information about what Pioneer found just disappeared, except from a few of these places. And one of these places was, when you look up that page, you see a picture of the Pioneer Probe 10, and you see the trajectory that it took. And I quote, it says, and this is all it says. This is literally the only thing it says in the caption. But there's a photo that goes with it, and I'll describe the photo really quick in a second. It says, Pioneer 10 became the first craft to pass into interstellar space in 1983. The diagram shows the path of the two Pioneer probes. And again, it says nothing about any of what the Pioneer probes found, which is so peculiar if you
right.
think about it. So in the picture, it shows all of a sudden that there is this star that it calls the 10th planet, because at the time Pluto was a planet. And it says that this 10th planet is found 5 billion miles away. And this is in 1983. 5 billion miles away from Earth. But it also finds, and this is what's amazing, even beyond a planet, it finds what it calls a dead star. It clearly states that. It shows it right beyond it. But it says this dead star is 50 billion miles from Earth. And that's why no one can see it and really have and understand its influences, because we have this hidden a struggle between our sun with this lost binary twin that exists far out in what's known as our outer solar system. And this is beyond what's called the Kuiper Belt. And the Kuiper Belt is this discovery that was only made in the 1990s, where they found that beyond Neptune and Uranus, there's this massive asteroid field and comet field that dwarfs the one that's between Mars and Jupiter by a significant amount. So large, in fact, that it actually encompasses our inner solar system. But outside of that Kuiper Belt, that's where Pioneer 10 probe found these two anomalous objects. And those two objects are what is both influencing asteroids and comets within the Kuiper Belt and some of these torrid meteor showers, as well as potentially influencing our sun. And is that why we're going through these cycles of destruction? Are these two bodies somehow disturbing the sun and is part of why it's going through these cycles? Perhaps. We don't know. But what we do know is that this lost binary sun, which this information would completely change our understanding of our solar system. And it's people don't want to accept the idea of a conspiracy theory or something that's being covered up. But plain and simple,
right.
This is being covered up. It's right in the encyclopedia. It shows the image of all of these discoveries, and yet it mentions nothing about them.
Are you convinced, though, Matthew, that we are headed for another calamity?
Well, I don't want to alarm people. I'm not a fear-based person, and I want to state that right away. I do think that there's a lot of different circumstances right now than back then. Back then, when these megalithic civilizations were around, you know, building incredible structures like in Baalbek, Lebanon, where you have the Trilithon block that's over 1,000 tons. You know, the sophistication of these civilizations is beyond our comprehension now. But when you look at those cataclysms that destroyed those civilizations and how sophisticated they were, it makes you really concerned about now, especially when you think about how we're in these cycles, and we're in yet again one of those cycles. However, like I said, during that time period, they had a massive ice age where the Laurentide ice sheet in North America reached depths of over 1 to 2 miles deep. And that was one of the reasons why the biblical flood was talked about and how there was a deluge. And you've got to remember, these civilizations built along the coast all around the world. When the ice age rapidly melted, it raised sea levels 400 feet globally, flooding all of these ancient cities around the world. And that's why you can, when you dive down off of Egypt and off of places off of India, you can find these civilizations, and the ruins are still there. In fact, I just want to throw a really quick thing out there. Some pilots actually noticed, and they made notice and mentioned that during the tsunami that killed so many people in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, a couple hundred thousand.
It was a horrible disaster. But one of the things that people don't know is before a tsunami, the ocean will actually recede quite significantly.
It goes way back out.
Way back, right? Because if it has to pull its energy back to form that wave.
If you see that happening, head for the hills.
That's right. And the animals are always the first to go inland, and the birds. So follow them if they do that. They know. Well, anyway, so what happened was when the ocean receded off of India during this time period, they saw ancient civilization structures underwater that it could be seen as this ocean receded. And then as it came in, they disappeared again. And you find that those underwater structures are all around the world. And they're there because this destruction occurred in our past. Now, like I said, the reason I'm saying that is we don't have an ice age anymore. We don't have all that water that could flood like before. We do have some ice caps, and they could raise sea level, but nothing like we saw back in the day. That's one factor. Two, the second thing is we have technology that they did not have back then. We have, and I know one of the things that it's a subject that people don't like to talk about is the idea, well, why are they spraying these reflected particles into our sky?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are those
chemtrails
or are those actually something else?
What do you think?
And I think that the evidence is very clear when you go look. There have been complete breakdowns of this by, you know, the FBI in hearings in Congress. They talk all about it. They actually call it an SEI program, stratospheric aerosol injections. And it's yet another one of these conspiracies that people get lumped together and they think they can't believe in just because they get labeled. But look, it's happening all around us. And the fact is, they're not contrails. And what they are is, it's a global initiative to secretly not alarm the public by spraying highly reflective particles in the upper atmosphere, aluminum and barium, so that you can reflect incoming solar radiation. Because the idea is, if they can reflect enough of it over time, they will not have a weakening of the electromagnetic grid around our Earth, and we will not have one of these pole shift disasters that happened to our last civilization. So when people think, well, the way you can learn about the past and to not repeat it is to study, well, that's exactly what they did.
Do you think, Matthew, that this information that we've been talking about tonight has been suppressed and covered up?
I do. I think it's significant suppression, and again, it's we can't label people conspiracy theorists anymore. A lot of information and things in the past that we've been told are not exactly the way it is, and it is largely based on a very deceptive model that's occurred for a very long time, as you know, George. And there's been a certain doctrine that's been taught to society about how old human civilizations are. Okay, we're told they're 6,000 years old, and then everything that we've been achieved came from us, and then we slowly got to the point where we are now from only 6,000 years of accumulated history, and that represents everything, and there's nothing else, right? That's the whole story, whereas all of these ancient writings that have been suppressed and then burned down, destroyed, like the Library of Alexandria contained literally the wisdom of Atlantis. That's what the Library of Alexandria was. It was the wisdom that had been accumulated from the ancient Egyptian societies and those around the world that was held there. Well, the Roman Empire came in and burned the whole thing down, destroyed it. And then before that, like I mentioned, the Ashurbanipal Library containing all these tablets. these conquering armies came in and they destroyed and destroyed the entire area and burned everything to the ground and destroyed it. We see this repeated cycle over and over again of information being destroyed or suppressed and held back. I want to bring up another, just a quick point. When the Spanish conquered the Americas with the civilizations of the Americas, which were, in my opinion, the attempt to restart Atlantis. And you know that when you go to places like Tula, Mexico, with these giant statues that are known as the Atlantean warriors in the Aztec capital there. And so we find these lost civilizations in the Americas. When the Spanish came there, they conquered the region. They stole all of these ancient writings and artifacts. And to this day, most of those ancient artifacts and writings are held underground in what's in the place called the Vatican Archives. And that same location,
hidden away,
where a lot of these other ancient writings are as well, because they go against this biblical Darwinian version of doctrine of reality that we've been given, which is very, very antiquated and inaccurate.
Are they petrified that this information can't get out?
They are. They're incredibly scared because, like I said, we have this entire status quo that's been created here, right? People have this identity of, oh, well, this is who I am. These are my origins of where I came from. This is what defines me. And based on what defines our reality here in our existence, it helps to shape what we're going to do and what we decide to do in our lives. What I mean by that is, if people were able to actually read what these tablets state about the incredible human origins and that we're not just some evolved, intelligent ape, but we're actually like a being from the stars. We're a being that is far beyond the animal kingdom, and that we have a lot of these special traits that have been lost largely within us, and that over time, our entire perspective of us, what makes us who we are in consciousness, in the secrets of the past, have been so covered up that people have this very antiquated and inaccurate perspective of who they are, you know, that they think they're just some person that's like an organic ape that's walking around consuming and just accumulating wealth and then dying, and then it doesn't really matter anything that they do. Their actions don't matter, whereas everything that we do matter. We're all part of this collective society who is all trying to move to the next stage of our conscious evolution. And unless we can actually define what the human experience is and allow the truth about the past to come out, we're not going to really be able to move ahead. We're going to just stay stuck in this really antiquated mentality that has been held back and protected for so long.
What fascinates me, though, is how the ancients did what they did, and then the knowledge generally is gone. It's either lost, it stopped, but it's like gone. Like, for example, the pyramids. What happened?
I think a lot of that was because of those cataclysms that occurred. We're talking about literally a complete reset of civilizations on the planet. Now, and that's why all this is gone. A lot of those elders and mystics from that time period, most of them were killed. And so the ones who survived tried to reestablish civilization. And it's talked about that very extensively. And not even those elders, but some of the Anuna tried to restart civilization as well after the destruction. And I want to just bring up a tablet that proves that and it gives us some evidence to actually understand that. And it's called The Legend of Atanya, and it's a cuneiform tablet from Mesopotamia. And what is so important about that tablet, it is the only tablet we have that describes what happened right after the flood occurred. I mentioned the Atrahasis talks about the event.
Well, let's talk about that when we come back, Matthew, and we'll take the final calls as people have lined up to talk with you here on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Stephen Cohen joins us with his second part two of the Russia-Iranian situation and what it all means to us. And then later on in the program, Leslie McQuirk joins us to talk about her work as an astrologer and Mercury retrograde. Things are going really weird these days, and people are blaming Mercury retrograde. So we'll find out a little bit more from her about that. And we are back, our final segment with Matthew LaCroix. His website, of course, is his Facebook account and also thestageoftime.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. He has a YouTube channel with his name, Matthew LaCroix, as well. And Matthew, before we go to calls, let's wrap up the legend of Etana. What is that?
Okay. So the legend of Etana, like I was mentioning, that Atrahasis, the name Atrahasis was his name as a king, and he was a king that ruled Shurupak. Well, Etana was also a king, but Etana was actually the king of the first city that emerged after the destruction that occurred, that we were mentioning during the Younger Dryas, that destroyed these lost civilizations. And what they attempted to do was restart civilization and create a new one. And the first, according to these tablets, the very first city that was ever created after the destruction was known as the city of Kish. And so what I call that is the post-diluvian history of our past versus the pre-diluvian history, which meant before the flood. So Kish is talked about as being the first city that's created, and that's the word I want to really emphasize. It's created, not just comes out of nowhere. And I want to just read a one paragraph how the legend of Etana starts, a one paragraph description. And this really will blow people's minds because it completely alters our perspective of where everything came from. You know, where the laws of our system came from, where our governing structures came from, where everything came from. And so Tablet 1 of the Legend of Etana starts by saying, they planned a city. The gods laid its foundations. They planned the city of Kish. The Ajiji founded its brickwork. Let him be their people's shepherd. Let Etana be their architect. The great Anunnaki gods, ordainers of destinies, sat taking their counsel concerning the land. The creators of the four world regions, establishers of all physical form. So there you get a really interesting perspective of these great Anunnaki beings that they call themselves the ordainers of destinies, who decided that Etana would be the architect of the new world. And that's why this is so significant. He's literally the architect of the entire new world. And so Etana is then, just like Hammurabi was, if you read later on, he's giving all these moral laws and codes to follow, to create civilization in a certain way. And that's exactly what happens. So after Kish, you get all these other cities like Uruk that develop around the Mesopotamian region, which is what's been so confused with being, so these cities are this old, and this is part of this time period in human history, whereas these cities in Mesopotamia were either built before and then rebuilt after, or were built from scratch. And
all
some
right.
of them are just buried under sand and exist out in the middle of the desert, and few people even know about them.
Let's take text and tweets and phone calls as well. Tom, what do you have for us?
Hey, Matthew, this one from Jerry in New Mexico. He says, can Matthew please talk about the powerful dream that Muana, wife of Etana, dreamt about?
Do we know about that?
The dream that Etana dreamt about? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah,
did she have one?
So Etana, the main body of the story is, that's the intro I read, but later on the main body has this entire part that's talking about this parable between the eagle and the serpent. And I did a show with this with George a while back discussing this symbolism that you can find all throughout history and throughout the world of this struggle between the eagle and the serpent and what it really means. And so what Etana says in this parable, and he's using some interesting ways to describe it that seem like just some fable and some poem, but really it's describing the events of the past. And he essentially describes how the serpent, in this example, this figure of the serpent, just like in the biblical reference of the serpent, but in this case, the serpent is tricked by the eagle in this legend of Etana to go down and rule in the underworld, whereas the eagle is then allowed to rule in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it states, essentially. And that's the same story that's talked all throughout history and then goes all the way back to biblical terms, whereas these beings, if you want to call them these ordainers of destinies, they actually are mostly non-physical, and they actually assume different roles within our reality. As mind-blowing as that is to consider, that's what the entire legend of Etana essentially states, is that there was a struggle that emerged between the two sides, and essentially took on these symbols to reference themselves. And the serpent became referenced with Enki, and this wisdom bringer, and not a deceiver, like religion later painted. Because remember, the serpent was the one who gave the knowledge of good and evil, knowledge, whereas this other figure that's sometimes been referenced as God in this in that biblical reference story, but really it's not God at all. It's this competition between the two. And in that case, that other being that's referenced to the eagle is known as Enlil. And if you remember before, I talked about how Nineveh was ruled over by Enlil, who was known as Ashur at the time, who was competing with other gods. So the story of the eagle and the serpent in Legend of Tanya is essentially this parable describing the events that occurred which led to the how our reality turned out the way that it did.
To the phones now we go. First-time caller Mark in Los Angeles. Hi, Mark. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Great. Thanks, Mark. You're welcome.
Oh, okay. I got one simple question here. It's for the both of you. I don't remember if it was on your show or another show, but a guy came on with a theory and said that, like, when the dinosaurs existed, Earth's gravity was much smaller, so the Earth has been expanding, and I think that might be a question of where the monoliths got smaller and smaller and bigger and bigger. I mean, well, started big and then got smaller as gravity intensifies, grows with the universe. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, he was on our program and he did talk about that and the different sizes of the animals because of gravity. I don't think that gravity would affect a monolith, Matthew.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with George. I haven't seen evidence that states that gravity changed. I mean, gravity is determined based on the mass of an object. And so unless the mass of Earth changed, the gravity shouldn't change as well. However, there certainly have been time periods in our past when there have been very, very large animals, very large creatures that existed here, and then other times when they're much smaller. And I think the more likely scenario on why that happened was based on climatic changes and how during certain time periods, like during the dinosaurs, you had a climate that was conducive towards growing very large plants and very large lizards. Whereas later, when you had some of the destruction that happened, in which led to the emergence of mammals, and mammals had to start very small because they were living underground. And that's essentially where this all comes from, is they had to... Mammals were small because they were surviving underground, and they emerged, and then we find what we find today, which I'm not a complete supporter of Darwinian evolution by any means, but there are certain aspects of that that are true, and so I think that's really what explains it. What do you think, George?
Arrowhead embedded in the rock sounds interesting.
Well, it's here. I mean, in the Ozark Mountains, I still own it. But
The arrowhead is made of what substance?
Bill in Washington, welcome to the show. Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, hey, Matthew. It sounds like to me you're trying to find, you're trying to decode the past, and you're trying to find a common denominator to kind of unify everything. You know, good luck with that. It's a noble cause. But my question is simply this. Did you ever look at the Mulapin or the star catalog of the ancient Sumerians, you know, to try to kind of solidify, you know, your astronomical theories? And also, have you looked at any palimpsests, you know, the old papyrus documents that have been written over? You know, as civilizations went to war and one overtook the other, et cetera, these things were written over. I mean, writing tools and the parchment or the papyrus were there. Those were the computers of the day. You know, they weren't really, they were just written over. They weren't really erased.
What do you think of that, Matthew?
The Mulapin is really neat Sumerian. It gives us an understanding of basically what the Sumerians knew about our solar system. And along with the Mulapin, there's another one I want to mention. It's known, it's a cylinder seal that George is probably pretty familiar with, known as VA-243. And what they basically state is, well, here we have the Sumerian people, supposedly one of the first civilizations that were around, and they basically created what we think of as now as where we got astronomy and agriculture, mathematics, and all those things. But how could the Sumerians have known about details of our solar system before the first telescopes were ever created? And that's what all of this comes down to, You know, a lot of people have tried to argue that VA 243, which shows a depiction of these stars and these different planets that happen to perfectly align with the size parameters of the planets in our solar system. They have this depiction that essentially shows our a mini example of our entire solar system. So the Sumerians knew that thousands and thousands of years ago before the first telescopes were invented. So it gets, it brings you to two questions. A, first question is, did they have a telescope somehow? Was there technology to view the stars that we are not aware of now? Or two, were they told all that information and given that information just like they state? I think that's really, those are the two questions that come down to you. But either way, the details really don't matter, because what really matters is the fact that these ancient civilizations knew far more about our solar system than we ever realized. And the question is, how could they have known about that long, that far back?
Let's go to Sophie in Los Angeles now. Welcome to the program. Hi, Sophie.
Oh, hi, George and Matthew. I have a comment and then a question, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay.
The comment is, I'm not sure if you know this, but I'm pretty sure in Buddhism they talk about the 11, they have a 11 worlds. And, at any moment you can shift in between those. And then, you know, that seems to correlate with the string theory and stuff. So I was interested in your comments on that. And then also in terms of the other, because you talked about 9 dimensions, but also consciousness. So I was just wondering, like, you know, when we do healing or we have like a sort of a magical thing happen or a manifestation of something, is that when we are in a higher consciousness, when we're vibrating higher, so we have flipped into a higher version of this earth. And then if we are getting, you know, really down in our thoughts, we go into a denser version where things are much worse and nothing works for us. So I'm interested in your comment and ideas about those two things. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thank you. That's a fantastic comment, and you clearly know a lot about what you're talking about. I can just tell by your comment. That's great. When you're looking at string theory, like you've talked about, when you look at the metaphysical nature of our reality in our universe, you find that it's most likely not actually a universe. It's not singular. It's actually what's called a multiverse. And this takes you down that rabbit hole of, wow, reality is so much more interesting and strange than I ever imagined. And it really is. And that's, again, what a lot of these ancient writings talk about. But like you said, they talk about, in Buddhism, they talk about how there's these different realities, these different worlds that all exist at the same time. What does that mean? Well, it means that in this multiverse, it means that there are multiple versions of everything, all layered on top of each other, sort of like a cake. And those versions are fluent. And they change all the time. So you were saying, when someone reaches a higher state of consciousness and they're vibrating on a higher level, it seems like they're in a completely different reality. And then whereas when they're vibrating in a lower state, they're in this more dense state of reality. They're in this very, much more chaotic, unstable reality. I think that human beings, because consciousness exists on a multidimensional level, it's not defined to our physical reality. It can exist across the barriers of what we perceive as time and space. So we, in existing in this physical reality, at the same time, our consciousness is non-physical. So we're essentially jumping through different realities as we accomplish certain things and change on a vibrational and a conscious level.
Matthew, as we wrap things up, tell people where they can get your book, The Stage of Time.
Thanks so much. Please visit my website. I update quite often. And for those who want to go see these translations now, my website, thestageoftime.com, I include a lot of these translations there. And if you want to check out my book, thestageoftime.com, you can find links there for it. And to have what I consider to be an ancient history reference guide to protect all of the knowledge of the past, I really believe it goes far beyond any words that I can put to this or descriptions to try to understand it. To me, it was about me laying out two things. One, what's the evidence across the world that explains both what happened during the last ice age and to these civilizations? Two, what knowledge did they have, and what evidence shows that knowledge, and what do they leave behind?
You did a great job with it, Matthew. In the name of the book, folks, The Stage of Time. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.